and welcome to a new season of the Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Murtazavi, a journalist and political analyst based in Washington, D.C., and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Today, we'll talk about U.S.-Iran relations, or the lack of, the nuclear diplomacy that was happening between the two countries, or the recent developments, political developments and foreign policy between Tehran and Washington, and where we're headed as far as U.S.-Iran tensions and diplomacy. My guest today is Barbara Slavin, a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. Barbara is a veteran journalist and analyst focusing on U.S.-Iran relations. She has traveled to Iran many times and wrote a great book about U.S. and Iran animosity. The book is called Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Barbara, welcome back to the Iran Podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you. So let's first talk about where we are today. It's May 31st, 2023. We're hearing this week news, potential possibility of some behind the scenes diplomacy, or I would just say attempts happening between Iran and the U.S. with some mediation, possibly in Oman. So talk about what you're hearing, if anything is happening, anything is in the works. Some talk about an interim deal, prisoner swap. What are you hearing, Barbara?
Well, I'm afraid that the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still looks like it's dead. But we are beginning to see some diplomacy to try to patch together, I wouldn't even call it an interim agreement, but simply a way to stop escalation and roll back the Iranian nuclear program a little bit. I think the Biden administration wants to get through the next year and a half before we have presidential elections without any crises. And the Iranians want, as always, access to their money and some kind of sanctions relief. So we're beginning to see the outlines of what might be, you know, a pause in the Iranian program and a tiny bit of a rollback, which would give everyone a little bit of space to get through at least our political developments. I think this is in Iran's interest. There has been some de-escalation of tension in the region between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Syria has been readmitted to the Arab League. And I just sense a desire on the part of everyone in that part of the world to tone it down a little bit and prevent new crises.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, we also heard of the new report by the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog that's tasked with monitoring Iran's nuclear program, and the resolution of some outstanding issue. Talk about this new report and if that also gives you hope for this toning down for all sides.
It does. The report has just come out, and it suggests that the Iranians have resolved one of the issues, which was the enrichment of uranium almost to weapons grade at one facility. They've apparently satisfied the International Atomic Energy Agency that this was an aberration of some sort and that they're not continuing it. They have continued to enrich uranium at the level of 60% purity, which is still way too high, but they have reinstalled some cameras which had been removed from an underground site called Fordo and are providing access to those cameras to the International Atomic Energy Agency. So again, it's not as good as it was under the original deal, but it is a little bit of a de-escalation. And it seems that the Iranians also want to just tone things down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we did hear from both U.S. intelligence and we've heard this in the past that they don't think Iran has made the decision to basically transform what currently is a civilian nuclear program into a weapons program. But again, as you're saying, it's also the enrichment, the potential weapons grade enrichment that can then potentially be used for a weapon. So how serious do you think this threat is, or it's perceived from the viewpoint of the U.S. or U.S. allies in the region, Iran's neighbors, the current state of the nuclear program?
It's very worrisome. Iran has made enormous progress since the Trump administration very stupidly pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal back in 2018 when Iran was still in full compliance with the deal. That was probably one of the dumbest things that Trump did in the diplomatic field, and he did a lot of dumb things. So Iran has made all this progress. It has, many more centrifuges. It has a huge stockpile, enough for probably 3, 4, 5 nuclear weapons if it were to make the decision to go that far. But it has not actually started to build a bomb, at least according to our intelligence. And, they have the option. It's an option they can use at some point in the future if they so decide. But, hopefully they will not make that decision. This has always been, I think, a matter of political will, at least for a long time, maybe for 10 years or so. Iran knows how to make a bomb. It's just, will they do it? Will they make that decision? And knock on wood, they have not made that decision yet.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned correctly that Trump administration, for those of our audience who may not remember, the Trump administration, President Trump basically unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear deal during his term in 2018. He threatened first, and then he eventually did pull the U.S. out. And the deal, basically, as you called it, and many other analysts call it, it was on life support for a number of years, and now it seems that it's just dead. So what else is there? What's the alternative? There's talks of an interim deal, of some small measures or goodwill gestures from both sides. What do you think is the possibility for both sides that can happen now that you and many others consider the JCPOA, the deal, actually dead and basically nothing left to return to?
Yeah, the problem is that so much of the deal, expires in X years and so on. And so it's really begun to outlive its usefulness, even if they could somehow restore it. What's left is what I said, an interim agreement that scales back the program, freezes the progress at least for a while. And in return, Iran gets some sanctions relief. One thing that's been talked about over and over is Iran getting access to about $7 billion in hard currency that has been frozen in South Korea for years and years. This is money that is Iranian money that was earned in return for oil sales, and that got stuck there when Trump put sanctions back on Iran. And sometimes people talk about it as a way to smooth the way for Iran to release U.S. hostages. Iran is holding several dual nationals as essentially hostages. Sometimes it's talked about as an incentive for Iran to scale back its nuclear program. So it's been out there for a long time. There's been problems in terms of agreeing on the mechanism for transferring it, which banks would be used. Right now they're talking about using banks in Qatar. There has been discussion about how to make sure that this money is only used for humanitarian purposes. The U.S. has insisted on that. So that's taken some time. And, again, lots of reports. One hopes that finally this will happen, because there are a number of Americans, I'm thinking in particular of Siamak Namazi, who have been held for years and years and years on bogus charges, who deserve to finally come home.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, what do you think? You mentioned Qatar. Oman has also been trying to mediate. They have successfully mediated between Iran and the U.S. in the past, specifically on prisoner swap. What do you think is the role of Europe, U.S. allies in Europe? They were instrumental in the nuclear negotiations, the JCPOA. Where are they standing now as far as U.S.-Iran standoff in general, and also specifically about the nuclear program, prisoners, and these other concerns?
I think the Europeans have pretty much dropped out of the picture, as have the Russians and the Chinese. So it's no longer the P5 plus one. It's really the U.S. and Iran, with indirect mediation now from Oman and others. The Europeans will do what the U.S. wants, I think. They would obviously like to see this crisis ease, but they're very angry at Iran over other issues, as is the United States, frankly, a lot of other countries. And that has to do with Iran's provision of drones to the Russians to use to kill innocent Ukrainians, as well as Iran's wretched human rights record and the crackdown that occurred after the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, the Kurdish-Iranian girl who was killed last September. So the Europeans, in a way, are no longer really a big part of this. I think that what still gives the U.S. leverage is that U.S. sanctions are making it more difficult for Iran to trade with its neighbors. And Iran has made a big push under this current regime to improve relations with its Arab neighbors. But it can't really benefit from those relations without some kind of sanctions relief. And that, of course, only the U.S. can provide.
Mm-hmm. So moving back a little bit, basically, there was a window of opportunity at the beginning of the Biden administration, about 6 months when they still overlap with the previous administration and Tehran, the Rouhani administration. And the both sides basically missed that window of opportunity. And now there's a new administration, a hardline conservative administration in power in Tehran. The dynamic, the political dynamic in Iran has changed, and that has made things even more complicated when it comes to the very complicated U.S.-Iran diplomacy, or lack of. And also the global landscape has changed, as you mentioned, the Russia's attack on Ukraine, Iran helping Russia, and then also Iran's domestic crackdown on protests, the killing of protesters, Mahsa Amini, 500 others. How have these changes, these fast changes, basically one after another in the past couple of years, changed the landscape of where we are today? It's basically made it more difficult for the U.S., for this administration, to engage and try to resolve the issues.
It has indeed. I mean, the Russians used to be very helpful in this regard, and now they are obviously distracted, shall we say, by the war in Ukraine. There's also the China dimension, which has changed. There's now more of a Chinese role, it seems, in diplomacy in the Middle East. And, you know, China could be more helpful, perhaps, on resolving the nuclear question, but they don't seem to really want to do that because, frankly, they're benefiting from all the economic sanctions that have been put on both Iran and now Russia to buy oil at a steep discount. And they're, you know, they always used to defer anyway to the Russians when it came to the nuclear talks. So, as I say, it's really, you know, basically devolved now to the United States through Arab intermediaries that Iran trusts.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the region, we saw an agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, also going back to China, basically brokered by China recently. At the same time, we're seeing an expansion, or at least interest in expanding, the Abraham Accords between Israel, normalizing with some of its Arab neighbors. How do you see this regional dynamic playing out and impacting U.S.-Iran tensions in any way?
Well, ideally, it should be helpful to see a reduction in tension in the region. And I think the Biden administration very wisely congratulated the Saudis and the Iranians on reaching this agreement, because its primary result will be, hopefully, to end the war in Yemen, this terrible conflict that's gone on, that's killed thousands and thousands of people and impoverished a country that is already one of the poorest in the world. So I think that it has a definite upside. Now, there were some in Washington that were upset because they saw it somehow as confirming an Iranian victory over the Saudis in Yemen. The Iranian-backed group, the Houthis, has obviously done very well, and that made people upset. Also, there are some who saw this as postponing or perhaps ending the Abraham Accords expansion. We'll have to wait and see whether the Saudis are still interested in having a normal diplomatic relationship with Israel. The fact is that Israel is embroiled in its own domestic dramas now. It has its most right-wing government in its history. And it's extremely awkward for Arab governments to be consorting with the Israelis when they are making life even more miserable for Palestinians, when basically Palestinian rights are being taken away every day. And so I think that's more of a factor, frankly, than whether Saudi Arabia and Iran have patched up relations. It's the fact that that Israel is behaving abominably toward the Palestinians, and there are some limits even to what you know, states like Saudi Arabia can stomach.
Mm-hmm. As far as where we are right now, what would be your advice to the administration, and also looking into the future, sort of the toning down of the situation? We talked about the possibility of a prisoner swap or this interim or other agreements and deal. How do you see, first of all, what would be your advice looking into the future? How do you see it playing out as we see that Biden administration, that his first term is also coming to an end? The U.S. will be entering election season, and nobody knows what's going to happen for the next election or who will be president next.
I think the administration is wise to continue to say that they will stress diplomacy, that they are not looking for a fight with Iran, that they are encouraging the Israelis not to look for a fight with Iran, but to try to stabilize the situation. Again, roll it back, give some confidence that Iran is not actually working on developing nuclear weapons. And yes, get American detainees home, and hopefully this time Iran will not take more. Now, that's where I'm concerned, because we had an article on the Stimson Center website today about how Iran has basically turned to hostage taking, not just as a tactic, but as a foreign policy strategy that it's using more and more often. And of course, this is horrible on many levels, certainly from a humanitarian perspective, when you think of the families that have been divided by this horrible practice. So, you know, I hope we can get our people home, that Iran does not take more people. I think Iran also has some issues to deal with. We, of course, talked about the protests in terms of Mahsa Amini, but there will be a succession at some point to the current supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. And I would think that Iran wants a better economy and a more stable regional situation in advance of that succession.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to congratulate you here for joining the Stimson Center recently. And as you mentioned, I want to encourage our audience to follow your work at stimson.org. You have a website, a blog about the Middle East, where you also post pieces about Iran, including this one that came out today that you just mentioned. Let me also mention, name the prisoners that we're talking about. Siamak Namazi, a dual Iranian-American national who's been held the longest in Tehran's Evin prison. Emad Sharghi, also a dual Iranian-American. And Murad Tahbaz, who is Iranian-American and also UK, he has UK citizenship. In fact, I believe he was born there. These are at least the three Americans, the dual nationals that we know of, that we're talking about when we talk about a prisoner swap. And Barbara, I want you to also talk about the domestic dynamic a little bit. And I know you're also following it, the women's movement, the killing or death in custody of Mahsa Amini in September 22, protests across the country, woman, life, freedom, the main slogan. And we saw support, outpouring of support from across the world, every corner of the globe, and also here in the U.S., the administration. How do you see that movement, these protests, anti-government protests, unfolding in Iran? I know there that some groups and analysts here in Washington were basically seeing this as an imminent overthrow, regime change in Iran happening. But what is your read, and how do you see that domestic scene impacting U.S.-Iran relations or any potentials for diplomacy?
Well, it certainly is an impediment to U.S.-Iran relations. I mean, these protests have been put down, at least temporarily, with horrific repression. Women and men shot in the eye, executions of people. Iran has now executed more people, I think, than it ever has in a given year. Some of them admittedly for so-called drug offenses, but others in connection with the protests. So it's really left a very sour taste in the mouths of many people inside and outside Iran. The regime has also tried to marginalize various political factions that were seen as being more pragmatic or more liberal. It seems that the political space has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller every year now, particularly under this supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. So it's bleak. I mean, there's been a restoration of authoritarian rule, frankly, throughout the region now, wherever we look. Even Tunisia, which was the only country that had real democratic change in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, they're back in under autocratic rule. Erdogan has just been reelected in Turkey. In Egypt, you have Sisi, who is, of course, a horrible authoritarian figure. Israel, as I mentioned, has its most right-wing and intolerant government in its history. Lebanon is in crisis. I mean, it's really a pretty bleak picture wherever you look, which is why anything that can bring some relief to people, that can stabilize the situation and bring some practical benefits, I think is maybe the best we can hope for at this time. There will be a change in Iran at some point. It's a very well-educated, sophisticated society ruled by people who are, you know, trying to bring back the 7th century, and it's absurd and everyone knows it, but it may have to wait until the death of Ayatollah Khamenei before we can see really significant change. I think we have to keep encouraging change. We have to work as hard as we can to encourage people there to continue to protest peacefully against this regime. But we also have to deal with this government. And as unsavory and unpleasant as that may be, it is the government of Iran right now. And, you know, we have business that we have to conclude with it, like making sure that Iran doesn't develop nuclear weapons, like getting our hostages freed.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, how do you see, you talked about the government, we talked about the protests and movement inside the country. What about people to people? Of course, Iran and the U.S. are not just our governments, they're also people. You always have great ideas about how connections or suggestions on people to people that has been done over the years one way or the other, sports, diplomacy, art. What do you think can be done now to, first of all, be supportive of the civil society, of these protests and the movement, the women and men inside Iran, and also to help more of this people to people and separate from the government connections?
Well, the people to people type stuff with the U.S. is a little bit complicated now. And Americans are obviously unwilling to go to Iran where they might be seized as hostages. But I think that we should begin by taking more students. Many more Iranian students. They're usually very well qualified and, you know, contribute to the United States, contribute to startups, brilliant in STEM fields. We should do even more sanctions relaxation so that American tech companies can employ Iranians working remotely, because these are, as I say, very, very expert coders and whatnot. I have a personal request. I have Iranians who write blog posts for our blog, Middle East Voices. I can't pay them. There is no way to pay them because of sanctions. And they write very well, and God knows they need the money. You know, why should it be so difficult to be able to pay people who are doing good work and who are trying to be constructive in terms of U.S.-Iran relations? So this is my plea to whoever out there in the Treasury Department is in charge. Find a way for us to be able to employ Iranians to do the work that they can do and maintain these connections. You know, the only sort of upside of COVID was that we got used to doing a lot of things remotely. So we can, you know, we can have panel discussions, that sort of thing, with Iranians. We can have guest speakers and lecturers, that sort of thing, from Iran using these tools. Keep up the connections any which way we can, on social media, you name it. Just try to show that there is a human side to Iran. There are people in this country who still are interested in a good relationship with the West, who are not enthralled with this look east policy that the regime is involved in terms of only focusing on China. I would say most Iranians still look west. The diaspora is in the West, their relatives are here, and they identify much more with Western culture than they do with the culture of a country like China. So let's not cut people off. Let's try to make it as easy as possible for Iranians to stay in touch, at least remotely, with people in the West.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, Barbara, I want to thank you so much for joining the Iran podcast. I know you had a busy day, but I really appreciate it.
I do as well, and I'm very, very glad that you're able to do this again. I think it's a tremendous service for people who care about these issues.
Thank you. That was Barbara Slavin, a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. I encourage you to follow her work at stimson.org. You can also follow her on Twitter at BarbaraSlavin1. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Iran Podcast, a project sponsored by the Center for International Policy in Washington. You can find us on major podcast apps, so please subscribe to us and leave a review and rating to help us be seen and heard by more audiences. You can also follow us on Twitter at Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Murtazavi. Until next week, goodbye. Thank you.